Gettysburg Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast. Conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more. With voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Hi, this is Kristen Largen here with the Seminary Explorers podcast from Gettysburg Seminary, and I'm very delighted to have with me as my guest today the Reverend Carolina Nikula, who is with us for the year. She is from Finland, and she's here with her husband, Pekka Laukarinen, and she is working right now, almost done with her PhD from the University of Helsinki in the Department of Theology, but under the kind of heading of social ethics. And she considers herself a healthcare ethicist, so we're going to be hearing some conversations about all those terms and what the field is like now in Finland and how that relates here. And she's writing a very interesting dissertation, and so I'm very excited to have her with us, and I'm looking forward to this conversation. So, Carolina, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, first, Carolina, why don't you say a little bit about your background and how you got into this field?
How I got into healthcare ethics.
Yes.
Yeah. I started studying theology in the University of Helsinki in 2004. And I didn't start studying, I didn't first understand that I wanted to end up to become a pastor, but I was really interested in different disciplines. And I thought that studying theology in Finland, you can combine a lot of different disciplines, history, philosophy, languages, theological stuff, and religion, and that kind of things. And then quite soon, I found out that I could pick social ethics as my major. And Professor Jana Hallama, she's really interesting, and I think she's really good in what she's doing. And I wanted to go into her seminary for my bachelor's thesis, I guess that's how you can call it. And I started doing little research in healthcare ethics, mainly of the thinking of Martti Lindqvist, who is a Finnish pastor and theologian and social ethicist. And then I carried on with Jana Hallama's graduate seminar, and I did my master's thesis in pre-implantation genetic diagnosis.
Okay.
And then at the same time, I was talking to Professor Hallama, that telling her that I would be interested to carry on for a PhD, and this is how I ended up working with PhD thesis in the field of healthcare ethics.
Yeah. At what point did you decide you did want to become a pastor?
I think that was, I started in 2004, and I graduated quite fast, actually. I think I decided that 2006, and then I graduated the next year.
Okay.
Yeah, it was, I think for people close to me, it was obvious what was going to happen.
Right. Sometimes it takes you a little longer to come what other people are seeing. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about the field of social ethics, and again, you particularly healthcare ethics in Finland, and, mm-hmm. and what does it look like there? Mm-hmm. How is it evolving?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, social ethics that you can study within a theological department in Helsinki, I think it's very wide discipline. You can study a lot of different things. For example, like the classical examples like abortion and euthanasia and these kind of things.
Okay.
But then I think more kind of like newer stuff that is coming up, like for example, cochlear implant that I'm dealing with. But also really, I think, interesting stuff, and not only within healthcare ethics, but this is what I've been dealing. So I consider myself probably mostly as healthcare ethicist, besides being a theologian. And I understand that as something being kind of like under or with cooperation with bioethics.
Okay.
It was first invented like in the 60s and 70s, kind of like to challenge medical ethics, because a lot of people saw it as something that is really doctor-driven and dominated by the doctors. And so with bioethics and the point of view of bioethics, to bring different point of views to the discussion also.
Yeah. Are there, just thinking about the field of ethics in Finland and the role of the church, do theologians, ethicists have so I'm thinking ethicists that are church-based, church-grounded, theologically trained, do they have a strong public voice? I mean, do they play a pretty important role in ethical questions in Finland?
That's really interesting question and important as well. And I think Finland is a very small nation. We're 5.2 million people, and I think because we're so small nation, sometimes just one figure can hold like a big voice and I think the person that I mentioned, Martti Lindqvist, that I was doing this little bachelor degree thesis, was this kind of a person. He was also a pastor, and he was really also really talented social ethicist, and he was kind of like also working as an ethicist that all the newspapers would call, like,
oh right,
so Martti, what do you think about this issue and this kind of stuff. But like to popularize ethical and academic discussions, I think we could do more.
Okay.
We could do more. But Professor Jaana Hallama, I think she's doing a good job there, and also Professor Ville Päivänsalo, I think. But he is not a pastor, but Professor Hallama is also a pastor.
Okay.
I think it has to do with it being a small nation that
just a few people
leading
can have
figures can have
a strong voice.
But I think like overall, to me, it seems that for example, ELCA is way more like brave to take part to discussions and pastors
interesting.
Being loud, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've only been here for like 6 weeks, but this is how it appears to me right
now.
Yeah,
interesting. Yeah, it's always, and of course everybody has different opinions about what the proper role of the church is, right? But I think certainly, and we're going to talk about your specific dissertation, but people of faith care about these things. And so, it's helpful to at least be a part of the conversation. So there's a way to do some of that integration, so how the core theological commitments really relate to these important ethical decisions, right? They're certainly one of a piece.
Yeah, exactly. And this is exactly how actually bioethics was came up in the first place, because theologians started it, and I think it's quite easy to understand why theologians got involved with this, because as I say, classical examples, abortion and euthanasia, are questions that pastors it's natural, I guess, for them to be thinking about those. And also, for example, hospital chaplains, it's something you just run into those kind of questions.
Yeah. Well, I had said when Carolina had given me the Carolina, you had given me the abstract for your thesis, and I was really excited to see that what you're talking about is cochlear implants, because I've done just a little smidgen of reading on them, and I'm aware that for many people in the deaf community here, they're really considered almost an assault on the community. I mean, and so this issue about, clearly it's an ethical issue. Is deafness a problem to be fixed, even? Mm-hmm. And who gets to say that? And so I'm very eager to talk with you more about that and to hear the situation in Finland and kind of the work that you're doing. So again, how about talk a little bit about how you came to this specific topic?
I have to say thanks for my professor, Jaana Hallama, again, because when I started doing my PhD research, I was first supposed to have a couple examples within public healthcare where the choices that people face there are considered obvious that this is what they would be doing, but it's not necessarily should be considered as obvious the choices. And I had actually three or maybe even four examples, but then at one point Professor Hallama said that, Carolina, you should take a look of this cochlear implant case. And then quite soon, this was at the very beginning when I was starting, and quite soon I realized that this is really fascinating and really interesting. And so I'm So this is how I ended up like concentrating on like mainly cochlear implant. I still have some little like examples of other issues in healthcare as well, of course, but this is the main theme that I'm.
Well, say a little bit about that then. So I'm assuming from what you just said that the assumption is if a child is born deaf in Finland that the parents will choose to have cochlear implants put in. Was there one specific case that you started looking at, or no, just generally this kind of idea?
Yeah, it's in general, it's not empirical. I use some empirical stuff, but it's ethics and philosophy, you could say. So I haven't collected any data myself, but I'm using some like data that previous scholars did.
Okay.
Yeah. But, well, because around 90 or even more, like 90% of the deaf children are born for hearing parents.
Okay.
So they quite soon face the situation that they should try to solve the question of language somehow, because they might be thinking that, oh, this is something very scary. We don't know anything about deaf people, or we don't even know that sign language is a real language and this kind of things. So all the children in Finland, they are guided to go to one of these university hospitals, and then according to parents' experiences, they are offered cochlear implant. And of course, this is the understanding how this audiological or medical approach sees this case and thinks it's for the best of the child.
Right. When does that usually happen?
The parents should, or they are asked to make the decision by the age of one, because they want to take the best advantage of the capability to pick up a language. Like a human being has this biological capability to pick up a language. And I think there's important to make a distinction in the way how one learns a language and how one can just adopt a language.
Okay. Do you want to say more about that?
If you're learning, like I myself could start learning a language, which is like really takes a lot of hours and years and energy and this kind of stuff. But a child can do it easily, like kind of like naturally, if in her or his environment there is this language offered.
It
doesn't matter whether it's a language that's using visual or is it based on hearing.
Carolina, what kind of numbers are we talking about here? I mean, how many deaf children are born? How many cochlear implants?
Well, Finland is a small nation.
Yes.
And so we have about 25 to 30 deaf children a year.
Okay.
But worldwide, there's like 70 million deaf people.
Sure.
So it's not a tiny minority then again. And of course, cochlear implant is something that can be described as that not all the countries can afford it.
Yes.
So it's mainly like the countries that have the money for that.
Sure.
Yeah.
So when did people start doing it in Finland? When did the first surgery start being performed?
Yeah, in Finland for deaf children, it was 97.
Okay.
But how this whole cochlear implant was invented, it was first invented for adults, for people that lost their hearing ability.
Okay.
So in my thesis, I've been interested with of the deaf children, and the question is like completely different.
Right. Yeah, I would say that too, actually. It feels to me quite a different ethical issue when you're talking about restoring a capability that someone had before an accident or an illness or a disease versus a child who is born in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there an American with Disabilities Act? Is there a not Americans with all right. Mm-hmm. We have an Americans with Disabilities Act that sort of defines what disabilities are and provides certain accommodation and those kind of things. Deafness is considered a disability, even though, again, for many who are born deaf, they don't see it that way as a mm-hmm. problem that needs to be mm-hmm. corrected or something that needs to be fixed. Mm-hmm. What's in Finland? What's that? Mm-hmm. What's that like?
If I understand your question right, I think one of the problems in Finland is that the legislation,
yes.
the law, is considering deaf people in two very different way.
Okay.
Like in one way, deaf people have some rights in the constitutional law, and here I think we can see that deaf people are considered. Or deafness is considered as something that's valuable and we should appreciate it, and they have rights because they are deaf and they can use sign language and this kind of things. But then again, on the other hand, the legislation is considering them as disabled and handicapped, and they have some rights, or they get some help
okay.
and assistance because they
right.
lack hearing ability.
Okay, okay. Yeah. Are there schools where children can go to learn sign language? And
yeah, this is also, I think, a very interesting question, because we had, I guess you could say, like, enough schools for deaf people. But nowadays there isn't really enough schools for deaf people anymore. Well, because there's no really kids that are using sign language as their
because
all,
really the
yes.
vast majority are
yes.
getting cochlear
yes.
implants.
Yes.
Huh. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, what's your argument in your thesis then? You've been studying mm-hmm. this. You're mm-hmm. what's your argument?
Yeah. I would say my main argument is that there is no good arguments to give up sign language. I'm not saying in my thesis that we should not make these surgeries for the deaf children. I think it is something that the parents should be able to decide. But I like the main point of my thesis was to try to look for the arguments. Is there good arguments for giving up sign language? Because people are not using sign language anymore, even though it has a constitutional base.
Okay.
So I didn't find any good arguments for that, like in order to like even if the kids would get cochlear implant, I don't see any good arguments to give up using sign language.
Yeah.
Because I think there's several points why they should not give
okay.
up. Okay. And I think one very important is that like they cannot guarantee what kind of a hearing ability the child will get, and then after that, what kind of ability to speak based on the hearing ability one will get.
Okay.
And I think a very important question in this whole issue is language
mm-hmm.
and not just hearing. And I think language is something that can so greatly give more capabilities and abilities for a person, and it's very important in order to, for example, go to school, learn, study, think, express your emotions and this kind of stuff. And
do you feel like that's compromised in people who have cochlear implants and aren't able to speak in sign language but are in some way sort of forced to learn Finnish? I mean, is that...
Mm. I think that one big problem is that the parents are in huge emotional turbulence.
Sure. Yeah, of
like,
course.
To get a baby, it's a big thing. And then they find out that, oh, this baby doesn't speak my language. It's like,
oh, yeah.
They might think that, oh, she or he speaks Chinese and I don't understand it. Kind of
yeah,
like.
Right, right.
And so I think the parents are lacking information about language, first of all, to what all it is affecting,
yeah,
and bilingualism, which I think also there's data showing a lot that it's a big advantage for your thinking and like
yeah.
even just in ordinary life, it's always good to know
yeah,
four languages,
right.
And yeah, so yeah, but a lot of parents have, in previous studies, said that they have felt that there's pressure from the healthcare that they should choose.
Have the implants.
Yeah, and then choose off sign language.
Yeah. What is the surgery like? Is it a relatively easy surgery? Mm-hmm. They have it once mm-hmm. and they're done. As the children grow, do they have to repeatedly get bigger implants, or what's the surgery like?
Yeah, that's also a very important question. They say that the surgery is not the most difficult one. It's like I guess you could say ordinary. Uh-huh. The surgeries that do this are like, they have a lot of experience in that field. Mm-hmm. But then again, we can ask how much experience you can have with children if we have only like 25 30 children in Finland.
Right.
Even though it's supposed to be quite similar as with adults. But the very interesting issue here is that at least right now, the cochlear implants do not last for a lifetime. And a child will definitely need another surgery.
Yeah. Okay.
And more than one.
What were some of the theological underpinnings of your argument? I mean, I'm assuming, I don't know, given that you were in the Department of Theology, I mean, you could certainly make this whole argument as an atheist. I mean, mm-hmm, right? You could be having the conversation, but I'm as a theologian.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
What were some of the things that kind of shape your understanding about that?
Yeah. In my thesis, I don't really have a theological point of view.
Okay.
I've been thinking about that should I write an article afterwards, it would have some mm-hmm. sort of theological approach. But then again, our professor always says that we don't have to like put God into the questions, kind of like.
No, I totally get that, right, yeah.
And then again, I myself, I think that everything that has to do with a human being also has to do somehow with theology and
right. Yeah, no, I wouldn't disagree with that. I do think there are some pointed theological questions that mm-hmm. that this issue kind of raises, and of course mm-hmm. the one is, you know, what it means to be created good, and mm-hmm. and the sense in which for me there's a real balance between believing that there our uniqueness is valuable, and mm-hmm. and that the whole idea of a person as disabled needs to be problematized, because mm-hmm. often it's really the whole society that mm-hmm. needs a reorientation, not mm-hmm. an individual that needs to be fixed.
Yes.
But also a recognition that there are some real disabilities that are debilitating, and that if we can fix them, we should fix them, because it you know, I the line in John where Jesus says, you know, I came that they may have life and life abundant. I think people who are deaf can have abundant life, rich, full life, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and that they don't have to be hearing,
mm-hmm. yeah.
right, to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. So, but again, then the larger question is, who gets to decide that? And mm-hmm. like you were saying, I think one of the real challenges here, and this is, you know, we can make a comparison with children who are transgender, people who mm-hmm. are transgender, mm-hmm. who gets to say? The child doesn't get to make the choice when she's one, right? Uh-huh. Their parents are making the choice for her.
Yeah.
And what if she, when she's 18, decides no, that's mm-hmm. not the choice? You know, so I there really are some, I think, very rich theological issues here that are important to reflect on also.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I have one little note in my thesis written about transgender people, because I think it was there was an analogy in a way with the deaf children.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is I warned Carolina before we started that you're not going to believe how quickly the time goes, and so we are at the end of our time. But I really appreciate having the chance to just talk with you about this and hear. We're always so enriched when we have international students come to the campus, because we're able to compare a little bit about issues that are going on and have these conversations. So we're looking forward to more of these conversations as you are with us this year. So Carolina, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores from historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of Gettysburg Seminary. We invite you to visit our website at www.gettysburgseminary.org. www.ltsg.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.